Hey, everyone. This is Joe Hyler from SportsRehabExpert.com, and today I'm on the phone with Mike Cantrell. Mike is a physical therapist, and he's the owner of the Cantrell Center down in Georgia. He's a postural restoration certified clinician, and his clinic is postural restoration certified as well. So Mike has been an instructor for PRI. He's consulted and lectured all around the country, and he's come very highly recommended by a number of members on the site. So I'm excited to have him on here today to discuss PRI. We're going to talk about some of the principles specifically behind the myokinematics course. So, Mike, it's great to have you on here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. You kind of make me sound like a real big shot, so I better live up to that, huh? That's kind of nice.
A lot of people bringing your name up, so figure we got to get you on the, get you on the show here. So
there's no accounting for taste.
Well, why don't we start out then? I'm going to have you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background and you know, how you started getting involved at the Postural Restoration Institute.
Well, I had graduated from Emory University with my degree in physical therapy, and I finished that in 89, and I started practicing with my wife, and after a couple of years, we were doing our own separate practices. At that time, I was working at the University of Georgia. She was doing some contract therapy. Then we decided to open up our own clinic, and that was in 92. Well, hooray for us. We opened up our clinic in 92, and I was doing I was just Joe PT practicing my stuff and doing the best I could to treat patients and get them better. And I don't know that I was doing such a great job. I've never really considered myself this phenomenal physical therapist, and at that time, I probably was pretty terrible. Well, then I stumbled into a class in 1995 being taught by this fellow named Ron Haruska, and he sort of challenged a lot of what I believe to be, you know, fact. And that was kind of odd for me, and there I sat very passionately having discussions with him in the front row and saying, now, wait a minute, Ron, and, you know, clear this up for me. And so years later, I continued to go to courses to try to to wrap my head around this and gain a better understanding of the material, because it really, really is, it's pretty complex, and I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, so it took me a little while to kind of piece together the material. And but what was so exciting for me is I was accidentally getting patients better. And I was like, oh, wait a minute now. You know, I really am onto something here. And that was what ignited my passion. And so then I began to pursue it really hardcore, because I knew that the material was powerful at that point. And I was seeing changes in patients happening really rapidly, and that was exciting. And so that caused me to want to go and take more courses and understand the material better and better and better, and that led to my certification in 2006. So hooray for me, in 2006 I get my posture restoration certification that they had initiated in 2004. And then it was sometime shortly thereafter that Ron had tapped me to become an instructor for the Institute, and you know how that goes. Once you're an instructor in anything, oh my goodness, now I really have to know this material. So I really had to pore over this stuff, because I wanted to be able to answer questions, and that's just, you know, kind of kicked the learning curve into hyperdrive, and that's, you know, I just haven't looked back. And that's where I am now.
Well, and I think a lot of us have kind of that same story. I mean, as well,
yeah.
You know, you hear about, I know at least starting out, I probably felt the same way. I'm like, hey, maybe 50% of my people are getting better. I don't feel like I know what I'm doing. So you're always searching for something that's going to be that big difference maker. And, you know, PRI has been, over the last couple of years, something that's certainly made a difference in my practice, big difference. And, you know, a lot of other people on the site have been taking the courses, either going to courses, taking the home studies. And, you know, and then one of the cool things about it, like you said, just, you know, the more you learn, the more questions you have.
Oh, gosh, yes.
That's one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on here. But why don't, let's spend a little bit of time talking just about PRI in general and kind of what it is, maybe for those members that don't know yet. You know, I'm going to link back to, we've had Ron Rusk on here a couple times as well as some others. So I'll link to some of those other interviews so we don't have to, you know, go real in depth right now. But let's give a bit of an overview first.
Sure. You know, the Institute was founded on the understanding that humans are asymmetrical. And this asymmetry is really the result, you know, of things like diaphragmatic position, organ placement in the body, and neurological patterning, just to name a few. And so, you know, when you think about these things, what we have, if I cut myself in half, my right half doesn't look like my left half. And at face value, you think, well, okay, so what, who cares? But that kind of leads to some compensatory strategies. You know, I have to be able to walk. I have to be able to place my center of gravity over my right foot successfully and over my left foot successfully. And I have to concomitantly rotate my torso in the opposite direction successfully. But the problem with most individuals is because of this inherent asymmetry, we're not as good at shifting our center of gravity over our left side as we are our right side. And so consequently, that leads to individuals trying to manage that inability. So they manage the inability to shift their center of gravity left or right, and ultimately those compensations, if you will, kind of lead to pain or dysfunction. And so the Institute is basically saying, hey, there are ways we can help individuals minimize these abnormal compensatory strategies. So that's really what it's about, trying to minimize abnormal compensatory strategies, or at least recognize them and teach people how to better shift their center of gravity left and right and left and right in an alternating way that allows for reciprocal movement of bone on one side or the other or muscle on one side or the other. I have to be able to flex and extend on one side and flex and extend on the other.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and why don't we do the same sort of thing? Let's go ahead and give a bit of an overview, because I wanted to have you talk more about the myokinematic course today and answer some questions
sure.
based off of that. It seems to be, you know, it's probably the course I think a lot of people start out with. And maybe let's just talk a little bit about that in general and what that course is going to cover.
Sure. The Myokin course itself is for most people, the entry-level course. It's the first course that a lot of people take. And rightly so, there's a lot of basic fundamental foundations in there that travel on into the other courses. I've also noticed as I've taught across the country that it seems like most people can wrap their heads around that material first, especially physical therapists and athletic trainers. They can wrap, the dentists that are in courses have the hardest time with myokinematics. I was on the phone last night for a couple of hours with a dentist, and they have the hardest time with myokinematics. And I'm like, well, you don't necessarily have to take it, but then you've got these hungry dentists who really want to know. But for the most part, most PTs and ATCs and personal trainers and strength and conditioning specialists, they can really get a hold of this Myokin course. But, you know, one of the understanding with myokinematics is really understanding this thing that we call at the Institute the anterior interior polyarticular chain of muscle. The AIC is what we call it for short, the anterior-interior chain. Okay, so this anterior-interior polyarticular chain of muscle basically is there to help us shift our center of gravity left or right and hold us up against gravity. And so the myokinematic course is basically a course that's saying, hey, this polyarticular chain exists, and oh, by the way, a lot of individuals have a very dominant left versus right anterior-interior chain. And that dominant left anterior-interior chain is a neurological pattern, meaning that left anterior chain, when it is dominant, is reflected in special tests on an exam table or during a gait analysis. So I can look at someone on an exam table and do objective tests that tell me that this person is patterned with that left anterior-interior kinetic chain being busier than the right. And so if that's the case, then what I should see is objective tests that reflect it, and sure enough, I do. So that just tells me that this person is patterned. But further beyond that, it is also telling me that some of these individuals, as they're compensating for this dominance of that left AIC, what they are also doing is damaging stuff. They're kind of tearing themselves up in an effort to cope with this dominant left anterior-interior chain. So the course, Myokinematics, is saying first, hey, folks out there, we are not symmetrical. Hey, folks out there, there's a left and a right anterior-interior chain. And hey, folks, by the way, that left anterior chain is pretty busy. And that is the result of this asymmetry that we just illuminated. Now, we would go on and say, here are some special tests that can tell us that left anterior-interior kinetic chain is dominant. So learn these tests, become proficient at them, and now apply this to patients. And then what you can do is apply a treatment program that helps patients minimize that dominance of that left AIC. That's kind of what the myokinematic course is all about.
Okay. William, could you talk a little bit, too, about what some of the common asymmetries are that you're going to see as far as when it comes to, like, joint mechanics or joint ranges of motion?
Sure,
Maybe when we look at posture, look at the rib cage, you know, that sort of thing. Because when we get into our questions, it's going to help explain a lot.
Sure. You know, if we thought about a dude who was walking, you know, if you and I were just sitting here and we were looking at someone walking down the hall and they were coming toward us, if we took a snapshot of them and caught them in mid-stance on their right foot with their left leg swinging through, what we would see is that position, well, we would call it right stance. So in right stance, the torso is rotating to the left, with the pelvis orienting itself to the right. Think of the acetabulum rotating around that right femur. That right acetabulum is rotating around that right femur. My zipper is aiming toward the right side of the hallway. So that guy walking toward us, we've got a snapshot of him. His zipper's orienting to his right while he's turning his torso back toward us as he's walking toward you and I. So that would be right stance. And then we would look, and then we should see a successful left stance. Well, that left AIC is putting that person in right stance, and they're better at right stance than they are left stance. So what we would want to do is do some objective tests that might tell us some findings that would reflect that position. And what we see is that most individuals are in right stance all the time, no matter what position they're in. And that's a big deal, because basically what I'm saying is, hey, this guy that was just walking down the hall, if we put him on a table and begin to look at him, we're going to see that he's still walking down the hall, and he's still on his right foot. And that would be reflected through a number of special tests those special tests would be in the back of that myokinematic manual that some student got when he took that class. And there are things like, you know, an adduction drop test, an extension drop test, trunk rotation, straight leg raise, range of motion of femurs, adduction lift testing, which is basically a test that it's sort of a myokinematic functional assessment. I mean, this is, you know, some of the other tests are basically let me move body parts. Now that adduction lift test is, okay, I've moved body parts. Now let me see how well you move body parts. And so it's more of a, I don't want to call it a strength test, but it's a functional mobility test. So I'm looking for tests that reflect that pattern called right stance. That is the result of this anterior-interior kinetic chain.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Well, and one of the things I think I'll do, too, since you had brought up that adduction lift test, I had Julie Blandon on here before. We did an interview once. We did a webinar, and I don't remember which one it was. We were talking in depth about that adduction drop test, and she had told me about an article you had written where a lot of the different, you know, things that could go wrong with that test. That we'll link to as well. So.
Sure, yeah. I mean, a better name for that adduction lift test would be the how well can you shift your center of gravity into your left or your right hip and inhibit certain muscles while you recruit other muscles test. It's just too long of a name. How can you come up with an acronym for that?
Like I said, one of the big things I wanted to do with getting you on here was to go through some of the questions that we had from the MyoKin course. And some of these, you know, a couple of the questions are mine, some are from members, or just, you know, the folks I've talked to, that these are kind of the things that come up or seem to come up quite often. So,
and I'm sure I've probably heard them in classes when I'm teaching, you know. I'm sure I've heard them. So.
Yeah, I'm sure you get these quite a bit. So hopefully we won't have to go through too much backstory to get at some of these things. But, I mean, the first question I had, and you were talking about asymmetries in the body and what that left AIC, you know, a typical thing to see would be more internal rotation on the right hip because they're in the, you know, they're easier to get into that stance phase on the right, and they would have less of that on the left. But then again, the left hip many times will show with better external rotation than the right.
Correct.
So it's kind of a typical pattern, but a lot of times you'll see that people don't initially initially follow that pattern. They might have, you know, very limited.
They might have more. They might have. Yeah, go ahead. I'm interrupting you. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. But, you know, they could have, yeah, the completely opposite pattern.
They could have the opposite. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, sometimes it might be confusing that, you know, hey, they're not following the pattern. Now what do I do? You know, or is it just, you know, I guess that would be the question is, well, what if they don't present like I think they should present? You know, you're not just going to totally abandon the, you know, the process.
Correct. You know, because immediately you go, man, what is up here? You know, to me, seeing an individual with, for example, we know that we should see decreased right femoral acetabular external rotation. We know that. You got a person sitting on the exam table, you externally rotate that right femur, it's probably going to be less than the left. But uh-oh, here's Joe Blow. He sits down on the table. We check him, and it's not that. He's got increased external rotation. Or on the other leg, we're looking at internal rotation. Like you said, we should see less internal rotation of that left femur. But uh-oh, there's Jane Doe, and she's sitting on the table in front of me, and I see more internal rotation of that left femur compared to the right. So what's the scoop? Well, a while ago when I was talking during that introduction, I had mentioned that, you know, a lot of times we know the pattern exists, and what we're trying to really do with our test is illuminate any pathologies as a result of trying to manage the pattern. Well, many times you can have pathologies in the hip. Well, if I have a baseline, in other words, if I have a radiologist look at an x-ray, he has to learn what normal looks like. So he says, on an x-ray, normal is this. That bone should look like this. So if I see a line going through that bone, I know that that bone is broken. Well, how do you know that? Well, because normal doesn't look like that. So if I see, if I understand that if an individual is in right stance, and I know that normal for an individual in right stance is limited external rotation of the right femur and limited internal rotation of the left, if I see anything other than that, I know there's pathology. So it's really an understanding of normal. So normal is limitation where we just said. And then pathology is anything other than that. So it doesn't eliminate the pattern. What it's telling me is that this individual has damaged stuff in order to increase internal rotation of that left femur, or damaged stuff in order to increase external rotation of that right femur. He has damaged things to get more motion where he has no business getting more motion. So it doesn't throw me off if I see someone with the opposites or something different than what the standardized norm is. It tells me more.
Okay.
How was that?
Yeah, no, that's good. Well, then that leads, I guess, my next question would be, so, you know, you would probably also, I'm assuming you would pick that up, this is the way I look at it, if I'm doing, you know, that adduction drop test and it's positive, and then I turn around and I do, you know, what I call the old Thomas test or the extension drop test, and that hip just drops, you know, they make that test look, you know, what most people call a negative Thomas test.
Yeah.
You guys would call a positive Thomas test because, you know, there's no way they should be able to have that kind of range of motion through that hip. There's got to be some sort of pathology letting them, you know, get through that motion, if I'm understanding that correctly. Yeah.
Yeah, and we would still call, if that thigh fully extends to the table, we would still refer to that as a negative Thomas test. A positive Thomas test would be one where it doesn't extend to the tabletop.
Right, right, yeah.
But who cares? What I should not see, if that left leg, for example, does not adduct across midline, call it an adduction drop test or an Ober test, if it doesn't adduct across midline, it should not be able to extend. But Mike, what if it does? And tons of people do. You know, then we know that something has been overstretched or damaged in order for that hip to fully extend. And that's a big deal. And so it tells me that that femoral head has moved forward in the socket and begun to lux or stretch out some of the anterior ligaments. And it can luxate under that cotyloid rim of the acetabulum. And, you know, and many times these patients are going to say, yeah, my hip clunks and pops, or used to clunk and pop a lot. Well, you know, at that point I would say that was when you were creating your anterior instability in that left hip, in that left femoral acetabular joint. And, you know, everybody is a negative extension drop test wannabe. In other words, we're all stretching out that left anterior hip. And it's just some of us die before we get there. But most people end up successfully stretching it out, which is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to see that negative extension drop test, when I didn't expect that, I immediately said, okay, well, I know that I'm probably going to need to manage that a little bit on this individual. You know, it's not the end of the world. That guy, you know, Joe Blow walking down the street probably has a negative extension drop test when he shouldn't. Is he negatively affected by it? No, he's not in my clinic. He's not going in to see somebody. So until he walks in my door, I don't really care. But when he walks in my door, now I care. Because if I want him to successfully shift his center of gravity over his left leg, he has to be able to turn that femoral head into that socket. And equally, if not more so importantly, he has to be able to orient that socket in the right place in order for that femoral head to get into that socket. That's a big deal. So if his femoral head is, you know, quote unquote, dancing outside of the socket out front, he needs to learn how to get it back in.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd need to recruit the appropriate muscle for him to do that, or teach him how to do it.
Okay. That makes total sense. Well, and then I guess, you know, at the end of the day, I guess this is one of the questions that comes up a lot of times too, a question, sometimes even a complaint is like, so is everybody, you know, at the end of the day, is everybody just, you know, stuck in this left AIC pattern, although they're, you know, they may not present exactly that way at evaluation, but, you know, is that always going to be the underlying pattern?
Okay, two things. First of all, they will always present that way on an evaluation. They will always present that way. I've never had anybody not present that way. What you'll see on, you know, as an examiner, you'll see individuals who may appear to not present that way. But if you look at them closely, you've got a battery of tests that are telling you that they are indeed. Some of your worst patients are ones that have blown out everything, and they look like they just have no pattern. Well, what you're really dealing with is a massively unstable individual who is now extending at every joint and neurologically extending to try to find stability, and you've got a mess on your hands. However, everybody is in that pattern, and everybody does have a difficult time with things like adducting across midline. You'll see individuals who do adduct that left leg across midline occasionally. When you do, now you really have a major issue on your hand. But coming back to the rest of that question about being stuck, because, yeah, that's the nuance that I get a lot from students. I'll get that question. Well, you know, what's the deal? If everybody's stuck that way, you know, we'll never win. And what I like to think of it as is don't think of it as being stuck in a pattern. Think of it as a series of muscles, the AIC. I'm not stuck in a left AIC pattern. What I am doing is think needed. I need that left AIC. Because of the asymmetries that I have, that polyarticular chain of muscles, you know, that PRI calls the left AIC or the right BC or the right TMCC, those polyarticular chains are more active. So there's a battery of tests that illuminate how this individual has compensated for that activity. But he has to have that left AIC, and thank God for it. So that left AIC is keeping him over his right hip because he needs to be over his right hip because of asymmetries. He tends to be over that right hip. So thank goodness we've got a left AIC to keep us there. All I really want to do is say, hey, Joe Blow, you also have a right AIC. Why don't we learn how to inhibit certain muscles and recruit some other muscles to shift you into your left hip and turn your torso to the right? And in so doing, we'll minimize your complaints of pain or improve your performance. So now that is really huge because what that makes really is my goal very, very different from a typical therapist. The typical therapist, and I have therapists come up to me all the time, Mike, yeah, you know, I kind of dig that PR. This is before I'm teaching a class. Let's say I'm setting up my PowerPoint, you know, and people are, you know how you go to one of these courses and everybody's eating their bagels and they're kind of getting their coffee and, you know, there's Cantrell up there setting up his PowerPoint and making sure that the computer's on, you're right? And so some therapist will come up to me and they'll say, yeah, I'm really jazzed up about this PRI stuff. Of course, I feel kind of bad. I've got problems and I'm not really, you know, managing it well. I'm just not doing my exercises. And I always chuckle inside, and here's why. And I'll bring this up during the course at some point, and I'll say, look, my goal is for you to not do these stupid exercises. All these exercises really are tools to help you isolate specific muscle for inhibition or activation. Once you've figured out how to isolate, Now what I would like for you to do is live that way. In other words, I can't very well ask, you know, this is the old doctor joke. Hey, doc, it hurts when I do that. Okay, well, then don't do that. Well, the punchline really isn't, okay, well, no, do that. The punchline really comes after that. That's when the patient says, well, dude, if I knew how to not do that, I wouldn't be here. So what I would want is to teach the patient or that individual or that athlete or whomever he is, I would like to teach that person to now live this different way. Adopt some new parafunctional habits that allow you to remain reciprocal and alternating. Even if that left AIC still wants to be a dominant pattern, I've shown you some exercises to help teach you how to inhibit that pattern. Now live that way, because that's really where the rubber meets the road. Stand this way, sit this way, drive this way, think this way, walk this way, reach this way, dig in your garden this way, smack your kid around this way, do whatever it is you do, but do it from a different pattern, because that will minimize the dominance of that left AIC. I didn't say anything about exercise. I don't care whether you do an exercise at all. Now, let me just say, if you're going to jump on the ski slopes or you're going to run a marathon, you're probably going to have trouble because you're going to slip so deep back into that pattern that you can't get out. Well, guess what? You're going to have to do some of those exercises to manage that high-level activity. But the rest of the time and the rest of us, Joe Bag of Donuts doesn't have to do that. He just wants to work at his desk comfortably every day. No problem, Joe. Do these exercises so you can figure out that you even own a left side of your body. Now, once you've figured that out, now I just need you to sit this way, stand this way, drive this way, etc. So you'll never, ever create symmetry. PRI never has said that. What PRI says is what you're really trying to do is manage your asymmetries. Learn to be a reciprocal and alternating person and minimize damaging compensatory strategies. That's what PRI is about. So I'm always telling people, hey, look, man, relax your sphincter here. There's no problem. Just chill out. This is what you really need to be doing. And it really makes life easy.
Good. Well, and then, you know, of course, one of the other questions that always comes up is like, well, what about scoliosis?
Oh, I love it.
Is that going to change, you know, that obviously it's going to change the typical presentation, but yeah, so, you know, this question just seems to come up quite a bit.
Got it. Yeah, and I get asked that one too. So think of it this way. Scoliosis doesn't change the pattern. Scoliosis is evidence of the pattern. So there's multiple studies now, and they keep coming out, and I'm kind of digging this. These studies keep coming out about pre-existent spinal curvatures. You know, there's a guy named Kuhnhoven in the Netherlands that's really publishing a lot of cool stuff. And basically what he said is, hey, this is interesting. One study was analysis of pre-existent scoliotic curvatures and spines, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, something like that. But what he basically said was, wow, all God's chilling got a curve. And that curve is a right thoracolumbar curvature. And when you think about that, in other words, he has a huge statistical population of individuals with the right thoracolumbar curvature. In other words, convex to the right. Well, if I'm in right stance, I should have a convex curve to the right. But here's the killer. When I go into left stance, my convexity should go to the left. So that's kind of interesting because, in other words, what I'm really saying is as I go from right to left foot, right to left foot, my spine should right foot convex to the right, rotate left foot convex to the left, rotate right. That's what my spine should be doing. But mom was right. If you make that face long enough, it's going to stick like that. So what I really see is validation of what Kuhnhoven is validating. All God's chilling got a right curve because all God's chilling are stuck in right stance because all God's chilling are asymmetrical. So the scoliotic curve is basically validating the pattern. Here's where it gets tricky. There's really two kinds of curves in this world. There's the right thoracolumbar convexity curve that I say is non-pathologic. Congratulations, Joe Blow, you have a normal curve. The real tricky part is when you see the left lumbar convexity, right thoracic convexity, two-curve kind of guy. When I see a two-curve person, I now know that they've created a pathology to fake shifting into their left hip. Whoa. See, now that's a big deal. So imagine in the frontal plane, if I'm in right stance and I want to get to my left side, but I can't. Let me go ahead and take my lower lumbar spine to the left because I figured out a way to do it. And I'll damage some ligament, usually the iliolumbar ligament, but I'm going to damage some ligament to frontal plane, shift my lumbar spine to the left. Now let me hyper-recruit some left quadratus lumborum to keep me there so that I can continue to fake my version of left stance. But wait a minute, my center of gravity is still to the right. Oh, whoa, so that means I'm going to get a right thoracic curve. Exactly, there's the rest of that pattern showing up top. Now that's amazing when you think about it. So if I see a two-curve kind of gal in my clinic, I know immediately she's figured out how to fake left stance better than some other person who has one curve. And better doesn't mean good. So now what I have to think to myself in a treatment plan is, all right, well, if she has shifted into her left hip in a fake way by side-bending, I guess, or convexitizing, is that a word, by making her lumbar spine convex to the left, if she's figured out a way to do that, when would it be okay for her to do that? Well, the only time it would be okay is if she really was in left stance. So let me go ahead and put her in left stance. In other words, shift her into her left hip and teach her how to breathe while she's there, because that's going to immediately turn her spine to the right. Congratulations, I just reduced her curve. That's a big deal. Because now we're killing it from both sides of the street.
Yeah, that's some pretty cool stuff. I hadn't thought about it that way.
Joe, it is killer cool. This is what I'm talking. This is why it's so powerful for me. So I'm getting patients who'll come in here. I've got this 14-year-old girl. Well, she's 15 now. But I got this 14-year-old girl, 15-year-old girl that's coming into the clinic with a patho-scoliotic curve. So this patho-scoliotic curve is to me just a reflection of her management of an inability to shift into her left hip. So let me make it legal. Go ahead and shift into your left hip correctly on my terms. And, oh, by the way, can you breathe while you're there? Because I know you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Now let me teach you how to breathe. And what I'm doing is using an incentive spirometer to validate whether she's not successful or not with her breathing while she's there. And the minute I see her spirometric measurements going up, because normally she should be blowing 15, 2,000 cc's, instead she's blowing 200 when I have her do it. So I'm thinking to myself, how often is she going to do that on her own? What chick, 15-year-old, is going to suffocate? Nobody. So she's never going to do that until I teach her how. So now I can say, all right, young lady, lie down, do this, do this, do this, blow. She blows into the spirometer, up, you still suck at that. Try again, breathe better, blah, 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 find these abs, inflate that right rib cage, because the minute she inflates that right rib cage, she just rotated her spine to the right. That's a big deal, because that's called successfully getting into her left hip, successfully being able to breathe while she's there. That just reduced her curve.
Yeah,
I mean, that's cooler than the center seat of a cucumber, man. Very cool.
Well, you started talking a bit about the breathing, too, and this was going to, my next question actually had to do a lot with the breathing. And, yeah, one of the things I thought about, you know, before with the spirometer, but I've always been more of using a balloon. And I guess one of the questions that comes up again a lot of times is, do I use a balloon or don't use a balloon? Do you use a spirometer or don't use a spirometer? I mean, anything, you know, that you would look for in particular that tells you, boy, this person really needs that kind of that feedback, or they need that extra, you know, push on the exhale to get them to do things right.
I've got a young lady right now that I'm treating in the clinic. She has cerebral palsy. She's 23 years old. This is kind of cool. I got to treat her when she was 3 years old. And then, you know, fast forward in time, now she's 23 years old. So when she was 3 years old, I am no pediatric therapist, let me just tell you. But at the time, there was nobody around that was, so it fell to me. So I'm working with this cute little three-year-old girl, and we're making memories. You know, she's an awesome kid and doing great, blah, blah, blah. Did the best we could with her CP. She's got a good old spastic diplegia. Now she's coming in as an adult, and she says, Mike, I'm doing fine, but my neck is bothering me. And so I said, you know, let's see if we can inhibit that neck. Well, you and I both know what her neck isn't doing. Her neck isn't rotating because she is all about sagittal plane gait. So her pelvis is so anteriorly rotated, it's phenomenal. She's gluteless, and she can't get her ribs down. How's her neck going to rotate? It can't because her ribs don't rotate. So I say to myself, all right, I know that this gal needs to be able to fully exhale, because if her ribs are so elevated and her back is so extended because her pelvis is so forward, there's no way she can get her ribs down. So the first thing I said was, hey, let me hand you this balloon. Lie on your back. I want you to try to blow this up with your – and she's in a hook-lying position, so her knees are bent. Blow this balloon up. Oh, my. Here's the first words out of her mouth. You're not handing me a balloon. Why? What's the problem? Well, I'll tell you the problem. I've never been able to blow up a balloon. Well, now you and I both know, okay, we're learning something here. This tells us a lot. In other words, she's saying, Mike, I can't thoracic lumbar flex. Mike, I can't diaphragmatically flex. In other words, I can't fully exhale. There's no way. So, well, give it a try. So she tries, and she tries, and she tries. All right, sit up and try. Let me bias her into a little bit of thoracic lumbar flexion. Now try. Well, she was a little better. At that point, I immediately said, okay, balloon's too hard for you. We'll set that aside for now. Let's try something different. Just, in fact, I held the balloon in the air with my fingers, and I said, blow at the balloon. Make it move. I had it about 12 inches away from her mouth. And she had to forcefully exhale to make the balloon wiggle in my hand. And I said, congratulations, you're exhaling. And so I spent more time holding the balloon and having her blow at it to get her to thoracic lumbar flex and get her ribs down. So I'm kind of taking a while to come to my point, but my point is this. When an individual utterly cannot blow up a balloon is inappropriate. But if I can just get them the idea, the concept of forcefully exhaling to get ribs down, in other words, thoracic lumbar flex, then I've got a starting point. And I'll do whatever I need to do to get them to see that they need that. If it's an incentive spirometer stuck in their mouth and I'm saying blow, and they realize they can only blow 200 cc's worth of air following that inhale. Well, think about it like this. Let me erase the board. So, Joe, you're laying on a table and I sit an elephant on your chest. And then I say, Joe, take a breath in and now blow that out. You probably inhaled and blew out about 200 cc's. Well, Mike, what's the problem? Well, it could be this elephant sitting on your chest. That might be the problem. Now, if I take an individual who can't expand one side of their chest or the other, and now I close off every avenue of expansion except that place where they can't expand, and they inhale, it's the equivalent of an elephant sitting on the chest. And they're good for 200 cc's. Now if I teach them how to expand that area that didn't expand, I can measure how well they're performing. And lo and behold, as I see it increase, what happens? Two things. Thing one, they report reduction of symptoms. Thing two, they report reduction of curve on their scolio. Or in the case of my CP person, what they figured out was, hey, when I learn to exhale and I thoracic lumbar flex, my neck doesn't bother me. Well, duh, because your neck can now rotate. Where before it was in a pattern of extension because it was the only position they could keep the airway open in the first place. So to the short answer, that was the long answer to the balloon thing, but the short answer to the balloon thing is not all patients get a balloon. Patients who I need to learn to teach them how to fully exhale will get whatever I think it is that they need to do to learn to fully exhale. Balloons manage the next inhale as much as they do the exhale. Think about it. If I blow a breath of air into the balloon, I have to pause without pinching that balloon. And then what? Inhale. Well, that's just promoting eccentric elongation of my internal obliques and transversus abdominis. So I've got to inhale without the balloon deflating. That's a challenge. But what it forces me to do is expand the apex of my lungs. Because my lower abdominal muscle activity, my abdominal muscle activity is keeping my lower ribs tucked in. So they can't expand, which keeps me from thoracic lumbar extending, which forces air into my posterior mediastinum and the apex of my lungs. That's why I'm using a balloon. And the balloon is just a handy way to make that happen. But some patients can figure out how to cheat the balloon. and you'll feel their abdominals letting go. Get that dang balloon out of their mouth and teach them a different way. I would have patients laugh. When they laughed, I would feel their abdominals engage. I'd say, keep that. Feel that when you laugh. And they'll feel that. Go, yeah, yeah, yeah. Keep that. Now I dare you to inhale. And then they realize, wow, that's kind of challenging. Yeah, you think? But the minute you figure that out, you just figured out how to expand the apex of your lungs, which don't really expand that well to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a long-winded answer.
No, that was a great answer. I mean, it really helps with the explanation or the understanding of why you'd want to do that. But, I mean, that's, again, it's something you think, you look and it's like, that's so simple. It's something like a balloon, but it makes such a huge difference.
Dude, I'm not required to use a balloon. A balloon is a PRI suggestion. Hey, guys, we figured out that some patients can do well if you give them a balloon. It helps them figure out what it is you're after. But you're not a slave to the balloon. A balloon is a slave to you. You use it when you need it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the other things I wanted to ask you about, because one of the big, I guess, you know, first corrective exercises that you see people using are these 90-90 hip lifts.
Yeah, and, I kind of see those flying around the internet. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you see them everywhere now, which is a good thing. But I guess one of the big questions I guess I have is just knowing when to use the hip lift and which type. I mean, there's different ways of doing it, putting an arm overhead, shifting the hips, doing the left hemi bridge. There's many different ways to doing this. And I guess if there's something, you know, that you look for in your evaluation that would help one just to kind of know which one to pick and when.
Sure. First, let's just talk about the 90-90 hip lift to begin with. So all I'm doing with a 90-90 hip lift is sagittal plane management via a left hamstring. I'm saying to that patient, hey, your left half of your pelvis is more forwardly rotated than your right. Gee, it sure would be nice if we could find a handy muscle laying around that would turn that pelvis backward, in other words, posteriorly rotated a little bit. I don't care if your pelvis posteriorly rotates or not. I just need you to find and feel a muscle that might posteriorly rotate it some. Well, is there one? Oh, wait a minute. Yes, there is. There happens to be one called the bicep femoris. So that hamstring group, semitendi, semimembi, and bicep femoris, more importantly, simply because it has a higher attachment site on the pelvis, that's it. But that hamstring group on the left, if we could recruit that guy, that would posteriorly rotate your pelvis. Well, as it happens, I do need that because that left half of the pelvis is more anteriorly rotated than the right because of that whole stance thing we talked about earlier. Okay, fine. So if I feel like in my exam that I need that patient to posteriorly rotate that left half of their pelvis, I need a bicep femoris to do it. Is there a convenient position to put them in that might find that bicep femoris? Well, hey, yeah, we could put their feet on the wall and teach them how to kind of dig down with their heels, and that would sagittal plane posteriorly rotate that left innominate. All right, well, that's great. I like that. But, you know, okay, what else? Well, we know from the myokinematic course that there are three main muscles that we can recruit that will reposition that pelvis to something we call neutral, which is basically a quieter left anterior interior kinetic chain. In other words, no longer in right stance. Okay, so I might look at an individual and test them and say, aha, look, these tests are illuminating the fact that you are in right stance. So let me find three muscles that could take you out of right stance and put you in no stance. Neutral. Well, those would be that left hamstring, that left bicep femoris, a left adductor, the ischiocondylar head of that adductor magnus, because it internally rotates a femur, and then the final would be a right glute max. So what I really want is a left hamstring, a left adductor, and a right glute max, and if I could find some exercise that did all three, hooray for me. But I got to make sure that the patient can actually do that exercise that has them finding all three, because it might be too complex. Hmm. So here's the short, smart alecky answer to, you know, which 90-90 to use. Well, I'll use the most complicated 90-90 hip lift I can give a patient that they can still do without failing. Well, how do you know you failed, Mike? Well, I'll test them. And I'm going to see, did my objective tests that illuminated the problem in the first place change? did I make her or him better? In other words, did I get them neutral with what I did? If the answer is yes, well, hooray for the home team. But if the answer is no, I better consider changing what it is I'm having them do. So now let's come back to hip lifts, hip shifts. The only reason I'm doing a hip shift in that 90-90 position is to find and feel that adductor. So I'm saying, all right, I did a 90-90 hip lift. I found a bicep femoris. If I hip shift, I found a bicep femoris and an adductor. Well, that's pretty cool. Well, if I 90-90 hip lift and hip shift and then ER the right femur, I found a right glute max too. Well, I'm very cool now. I found all three. But there's one problem. That's kind of hard to do. In fact, just hip shifting is hard to do. And what typically happens when patients got their feet on the wall and they do a 90-90 hip lift and then they hip shift is they'll accidentally side bend right and recruit right abdominals. Uh-oh, I just buried them in the pattern because right abdominals are always on those individuals. Well, that's not good. I just screwed them up. How do I know I screwed them up? Well, you and I both know the answer to that. Test them. Oh, look, they still can't adduct across midline. Oh, look, straight leg raises aren't changed. Oh, look, you know, pick the thing, and nothing has changed. And you're like, well, okay, back to the drawing board. Let me scratch my head and figure out what I did wrong. Well, I know what you did wrong. You asked the patient to do more of what it is they walked in the door doing a lot of. Bad stuff. You just said, hey, let me put you in a position that I think will fix it, but I just made you worse. So adherence to the proper performance of an activity is crucial, obviously. So I would love to have them do as much as possible, but the minute they start to functionally fail, I'm sticking a stick in my own spokes. I'm going over the handlebars of my bicycle. It's not a good place to be. So let me do a very simple activity to begin with, a 90-90 hip lift. Okay, so Mike, when do I have a patient place their arm over their head laying on the table versus reaching for the ceiling versus nothing at all? Because that would be the next question. Well, if I have an individual, see, what I want to address is not just the left AIC. Gee, I sure would like to address that right BC too, that right brachial chain. Well, the right brachial chain tends to limit, because of its activity, the ability for that right chest wall to expand. By having a person drape their arm over their head, it'll make it a little easier for them to close down their left rib cage while they try to put air into their right rib cage. So I'm basically sweeping air under the rug, and draping that arm over their head that way opens up that right rib cage a little bit more by stretching out those intercostals and expanding inter-rib space. So it makes it empties the apartment for the new tenants to move in. We've got air coming into that right side now. So hopefully, if an individual can't breathe into their right rib cage, draping that arm over their head will help them breathe into their right rib cage. But some, it won't. How will I know? I'm going to retest. So what I would like to see is portions of their brachial chain become negative as well. But here's a nice thing. The diaphragm itself is part of both chains. By influencing that diaphragm, I can then have a person reposition their rib cage as well as their pelvis. That's why I always say diaphragm's king. That's why PRI is all over diaphragmatic function, because it really is king. So draping the arm over the head is really simply there to try to increase airflow into the right rib cage while also helping find left internal obliques and transversus abdominis. But sometimes it doesn't work. Okay, in that case, it's usually because they can't find their left IOs and TAs, those internal obliques and transversus abdominis muscles. So in that case, let me have them point their hand at the ceiling and then reach forward a little bit up toward the ceiling, which twists them to the left via, guess what, left IOs and TAs. That immediately closes down their left rib and forces air into the right rib cage. So it's each one of these variations of that 90-90 hip lift is done with the idea of trying to inhibit that left AIC and that right BC and to get airflow into the right rib cage by closing down the left. So if think of it this way. Let me give you an even better answer. Let's say that you have an individual with a really wide infrasternal angle. So that, you know, normal infrasternal angle is about 90 degrees. But if they've got like 110, 120, 130, I had a guy with a 145-degree infrasternal angle. That's wide, baby. So this guy can't even begin to think about exhaling. So I can give them a 90-90 hip lift, but to try to tinker around with their rib cage at this point is going to suffocate the stew out of them. Here's what they look like when they're lying on the table. Okay, Joe, go ahead and put your feet up on the wall. Okay, great, I've got my feet on the wall. Now I want you to take a breath in. Okay, now I want you to breathe out. While you're breathing out, I want you to lift your tailbone by pulling down with your heels. Now, God bless us if he figures out how to do that. But if he does, that'll be a good thing. Okay, now, Joe, here's what I want you to do. You got your tailbone up. I want you to finish breathing out. Now pause. And here's what happens. They think they're pausing, but this is what it sounds like. And I'm going, how's that pause working for you? Yeah, no problem. They don't even know they're breathing. They don't even know that they're panting. And these are chronic hyperventilators who have, they're hyperinflated and hyperventilating, and they, the idea of even figuring out how to exhale and pause for 3 to 5 measly seconds is an impossible dream to these folks. And those guys, I won't even give them a 90-90 hip lift at all. The first thing I'll do for them is say, sit up and learn to breathe out and pause. Can you do it in a sitting position? Now, why would I sit them up? Because that dropped their ribs. The act of sitting up and slouching a little bit could drop their ribs into some fake version of flexion. And I'll start there. I'm going to make it as simple as possible without freaking this person out, because if I made them breathe out and pause, they're going to panic. And they're the black belts of panic attacks already. That was a lot of dialogue. Sorry about that. It was really a monologue. Sorry about that.
No, that's good. It's all good stuff. I mean, it definitely helps with the understanding. And yeah, that's one thing, too, I found just the seated position a lot of times does help take care of some of those things on day one with just learning to breathe. If they can't blow up a balloon on their back, a lot of times they can do it in a seated position. And
don't you love it?
Take some steps back to then to take some steps forward next time.
Yeah, it's incredibly powerful. You can take a person and sit them up, and they can have a little bit of a success, and they're like, yes, I get this. I send a lot of patients like that, the guy I just described, I'll send them home with a Buteyko breathing disc. I'll say, go home, watch this DVD. It's the most boring DVD on earth, but what you're going to do is you're going to learn how to breathe out and pause, because that concept for them is the impossible dream. And I've had many patients come back just from doing Buteyko breathing. They'll come back and say, hey, my back feels better. Well, duh, that was the toughest program on earth, wasn't it? Go home, watch TV, come back, you're fixed. You got to love that.
At the end of the day, I guess I'd like to have you just kind of just briefly kind of say, you know, tell us why you think it's essential to have this understanding of PRI concepts to be an effective physical therapist, because I know there are lots of systems out there. There's lots of ways of doing things. This is quite different than what most other people are doing. So, you know, why, in your opinion, why is it, you know, why should other physical therapists be at least taking a look at these types of concepts and giving PRI a shot?
That is like the most loaded question on earth, and I love it. You know, in my mind, I think it's like, you know, as a surgeon, why do you think it's important to know sterile technique? Or you're an oncologist, why do you need to know about radiation therapy? Or wait a minute, you're a hunter, do you think you need to know about shotguns? Or what, you're a cook. Do you need to know about stoves? So it's like, to me, you know, we're in the sports rehab and rehabilitation specialists. We're physical therapists. We are the biomechanical experts of the medical model as it exists today. Okay, who else is besides us? We are it. We're the show. We're the biomechanical experts. And to me, not having a handle on PRI is like the cook not understanding what a stove is, because PRI illuminates biomechanics in a way that no other area of expertise really does. It tells us why an individual hurts or can't perform. PRI is biomechanics. In my mind, to my way of thinking, if you don't know about true biomechanical interaction on a left side of a body to a right and back again, if you don't know about that, any treatment that you're doing on a patient isn't objective and is luck. I lived it. I did that. I was dumb luck Mike. You know, I'd give them the stuff I learned in school and pray they got better. But what I've seen now is I can objectify and quantify my treatment because I've dared to try to realize simple things that aren't simple. They are complex, and I've dared to challenge myself and try to step into the complexity of it. Like some of my own mentors before me, I can now say, you know, very confidently, like an early heel rise gait is a respiratory dysfunction, PRI. A lack of trunk rotation, I mean, that means that ribs can't rotate. That's PRI. A supinated right foot and a pronated left foot, dude, that's, I expect that, PRI. How about an elevated hyoid bone? That's an extension pattern, and I care about it, PRI. Without neck rotation, gait can't occur. That's PRI. Breathing is walking, and walking is breathing. That's PRI. And when you think about things like that, how could you not know that? Because we have to understand biomechanics at the nitty-gritty. Because if we don't, who is? And if there's no way to objectify what we do, we suck.
And that's a great way to put it.
It really is.
I got you going with that question there.
Ooh, you sure did. I was busier than a centipede at a toe-counting contest. Man.
Well, that's good. Well, hey, yeah, I do. Unfortunately, I could probably come up with about 10 more questions for you right now, but I do have to get running, but... it was great having you.
It was probably
on.
Good. I never shut up, you know. I never shut up.
Oh, that's good. It makes for good interviews, for sure.
Let me just tell you, Joe, it's like when I'm teaching classes, I'm like, guys, you know, stop me because I'll never take a break. I'll never take lunch. I'll just be here at midnight. You'll go home. You'll come back in the morning. I'm still talking.
Still keep going.
Yeah. Oh, God. But listen, I really did enjoy it. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, it was great, Lisa. It was great having you on here, and I can see why so many people are recommending to get you on here. And like I said, if you're up for it again sometime, I'd love to have you back. And I certainly won't have a problem coming up with more questions, and neither do I think my members won't have a problem doing that either. So,
well, I would love it. It was a blast. I really enjoyed it.